From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. President Barack Obama wants to throw a $75 billion lifeline to homeowners in an attempt to stem the tide of foreclosures. Here is the president speaking at the launch of the Homeowner Affordability and Stability Plan in Arizona yesterday.
By making these investments in foreclosure prevention today, we will save ourselves the costs of foreclosure tomorrow. Costs that are borne not just by families with troubled loans, but by their neighbors and communities and by our economy as a whole.
In the meantime, Forbes.com has put together a list of the emptiest cities in America, all as a result of the credit crisis. Joining me now is Zach O'Malley-Greenberg. He is the reporter behind the Forbes.com article. Zach, welcome.
Hi, Tony. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Which cities are in the top five of America's emptiest cities, Zach?
Well, the top five, the fifth is Dayton, fourth is Greensboro, third is Atlanta, second is Detroit, and first is Las Vegas, all on there for kind of different root causes. But, you know, the situation is getting a little more dire as more jobs kind of go to the wayside.
Let's talk about what those causes are, because Las Vegas was just recently known as the fastest growing city in America. And I know personally that there's been a great deal of building there, a lot of it coming from California and other places. But what's behind this, particularly as it relates to Las Vegas and Detroit?
Sure. Well, Tony, what we have here is, you know, two really different situations, although it looks the same on the surface because they both have a lot of vacancies, both in rental and homeowners. The fact is that it's due to two really different root causes. With Vegas, you know, it was sort of burgeoning into this shimmering urban carnival of a city, and you know, lots of Californians building second homes there, buying condos in high rises. But Detroit has had problems for it for a long, long time, and the downturn really kind of hit both of them in different ways. So with Vegas, it was more of a matter of overcapacity. There were all these new condos going up, all these second homes out in the suburbs, and suddenly the market dried up, and you know, people had to sell their second homes and stopped renting in Vegas. Then in New York, in Detroit, what happened was, you know, Detroit has been hemorrhaging jobs for decades, and it's certainly not getting any better. You see in the news with everything going on with the car companies. You know, it's not like things are getting better, not like people are getting more money to rent more houses and buy more houses there. So, you know, that's kind of been the problem in Detroit for a lot longer.
Well, you mentioned rentals. That was going to be my next question, because the issue isn't only with buying, it's also with rentals. What's happening there?
Sure. I mean, again, you know, with rentals, especially in places like Vegas, there was an overcapacity, and a lot of developers started building giant residential towers in the thoughts that the boom would continue. You know, the rental market really dried up even quicker.
What did you find on the flip side? We know about the cities now that are the emptiest. What about those that are doing well in terms of their housing?
Sure. Well, there are a few bright spots. Boston and New York are doing pretty well. Actually, the city with the best stats in this is Honolulu. The vacancy rate is 5.8% for homes, but only 0.5% for rentals.
How did you come to those conclusions? How did you compile these statistics?
Well, our rankings were based on the data released on February 3rd by the Census Bureau, and that's the fourth quarter vacancy data. Basically, we took rental vacancies and homeowner vacancy rates, and we put them together, and we ranked, I think it was out of 75 or 80 of the what's called metropolitan statistical areas, or, you know, in layman's terms, you know, just metro areas. And we combined the rental with the homeowner vacancy rate, put it together, and that's how we came up with our rankings.
Zach, thank you very much for the information. It's helpful.
Thanks so much, Tony.
That was Zach O'Malley-Greenberg. He is a reporter with Forbes.com and wrote the article on America's emptiest cities. As we heard, Atlanta came in at number 3 on the list of emptiest cities. Joining me now to talk about this is Shirley Simmons. She is associate broker at RE/MAX Executive based in Atlanta, Georgia. Shirley, welcome.
Thank you.
So Atlanta comes in at number 3 on the list. From your experience, what's happening to the housing market in your city?
Well, the housing market has been heavily impacted because too many people who could not afford properties were given loans for them. They were given loans without having to provide any down payment. so their income was not necessarily in line with the ability to repay those loans.
What's happening to the housing stock then? Is it, are these homes just sitting there vacant? Are they going to, are they rotting, or what's going on?
They are sitting vacant. In many cases, we have brand new construction that is sitting vacant because the builders overbuilt. They are sitting empty, waiting on possibly someone to come and purchase, or builders and owners are beginning to offer the lease option as a possibility for occupying the vacant homes.
Is this happening all across, is it happening across all neighborhoods and price points?
I would say yes.
What lengths, Shirley, are people going to avoid paying large monthly house bills there?
They are pooling their resources. Families are beginning to move in with each other. They are leasing instead of trying to sell because the period of time that homes are staying on the market has probably doubled over the last 12 months.
And how long is that period now?
I would say anywhere from 9 to 12 months.
So you put a home on the market today, you can expect not to be able to move it for at least maybe a year.
That's correct. And part of the reason for that is because there are so many bank-owned properties, and those properties are priced far less than the homes who are being which are being sold by an individual owner.
You know, oftentimes, Shirley, investors will clean up in a down economy by buying property low and selling that property high. But that's not happening, is it?
Not as much as in times past. And one of the reasons for that is because there was a moratorium put on the number of loans that any individual can get. That is being changed, as I understand it. But right now, the limit is 4 mortgages per individual.
So take your business, for example. Are you finding that there is not much to do? Does your phone not ring? Do you not get emails? Are you not showing homes and having open houses? Or what's it like?
Well, I can say that over the last 4 weeks, my business has begun to pick up to the level that I'm used to in previous years. However, the first 6 months of 2008, I did not sell one home. And I normally sell at least 25 to 30 homes every year. So my business did not even begin to pick up until June of 2008. And all of the reasons for it include what we've just mentioned. There was too much building. People could not get financing. The financing has picked up somewhat, and my phone is beginning to ring now from people who are more confident that they will have jobs and that they will have the opportunity to purchase. Additionally, those people who are in the market are typically first-time home buyers, which is a shift in my market because I'm typically selling to the move-up buyer.
Are you finding that the banks are trying to make it easier for first-time home buyers in particular, as well as others, by relaxing some of the charges or fees or interest rates being charged to get into a loan?
The requirements for getting a loan are not being relaxed because that was the problem that is the situation that has gotten us into the current status of the home industry. What I am seeing is that the low interest rates are encouraging people to get out and buy.
What about people who are already in their homes in the Atlanta area who perhaps would want to refinance to get a lower interest rate, perhaps to take whatever equity out of their home that there is, if there is any equity left given the current downturn?
People who have many years of equity or were able to purchase at a lower level and who have significant equity can probably refinance very easily. However, if a person has only been in their home for a short period of time, maybe 1 to 2 years, the situation is bleak because the values have not increased.
What are you telling people? What would you advise people as we end this conversation? And I appreciate your coming on, Shirley. The information is helpful. What would you advise people to do who are in the housing market now? How should they go about trying to identify the property that is going to sustain value, and how should they go about trying to acquire the appropriate loan and financing? And I need you to answer kind of briefly for me.
The first key would be to select a realtor who is professional and can provide resources and advice that will enable them to make sound decisions in their purchase.
And in terms of getting the financing?
The financing, they should consult with reputable firms, those that they have heard of before. And the most beneficial way to do that is to seek the advice of a realtor.
All right. I appreciate it very much, Shirley. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Shirley Simmons. She is associate broker at RE/MAX Executive in Atlanta, Georgia. This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. During his presidential campaign, President Barack Obama laid out an ambitious technology agenda for his administration. Now that he's in the White House, how will Mr. Obama implement those ideas? Today, our series on the Obama effect continues with a look at the impact on technology. Here to size up Mr. Obama's tech agenda, our very own tech contributor, Mario Armstrong. Hello, Mario.
Hi there, how are you?
I'm fine.
Glad to be here.
Thank you. Glad to have you back. During the presidential campaign, we talked with you about President Obama's stand on key technology issues. He was candidate Obama at the time, of course. Remind us briefly about some of those issues, and now that he's in the office, what are some of the top priorities for his administration?
Yeah, well, early on, he had been very forthcoming about how he envisioned technology and the role that it would play in the Obama administration. And that dates back actually to when he was a senator, and he had put some other programs in place that were kind of like, if you can think of it like a Google search engine, if you will, back in Chicago. So he had some programs back then that he believed in technology could really assist growth and moving forward. And so you transition that now to where he is today. He's been playing technology largely to the point of transparency and to broadband access for all of Americans across the country, which has to date not been the case.
You know, one of the things that's associated with the new president from a technology standpoint that perhaps everyone can relate to was the issue of his BlackBerry and whether or not he was going to be allowed to keep it or not. Specifically, though, how has the president used technology, BlackBerry aside, to update and to revolutionize the White House itself?
Yeah, BlackBerry aside, when they first and foremost, the minute they made the formal announcement, the website changed. The WhiteHouse.gov website had an immediate makeover. In other words, they had already been working on developing that website, what it was going to stand for, how it was going to engage citizens, and how it was going to keep the same momentum that basically carried him into office throughout this administration. So, number one, the website made a drastic change and a tremendous shift. It opened up transparency. It put a lot of ways for individuals to feel that they could be more empowered to have better access or a direct access, almost like an open internet door to the administration. Number two, they look to hire a chief technology officer for the administration, which has been done. They've actually checked that off of their list. And that has never been a position within the White House to that level before. And then number three, I would say actually the stimulus package, coming through with $7.2 billion being placed specifically for broadband access in rural areas. Those are three key things. Oh, and the fourth thing would be upgrading the systems within the White House. Internet connectivity is extremely slow there. Outdated computers, viruses, just issues with just the infrastructure of technology that was there left by the previous administration.
You know, that was going to be my next question, because I understood as the new administration staff took their offices in the White House, what they found was were computers that were, I suppose, outdated and very slow and not nearly as technologically advanced as you would expect from the White House.
You would expect from, you know, the innovative country of the world that our White House. But, you know, leadership is driven top down. And I'm not trying to point a finger here. I'm just saying you can look at companies as well as government and look at the leadership and whether or not they adopt technologies. And so my point is that with the fact that they didn't seem to have old and outdated technology, you couple that now with an administration that's new, that basically, I say he made it into the White House due to the speed of the internet. So you have a bunch of people that are used to using Facebook, social networking, mobile phones, and wireless connectivity, and then you take them back into what feels like the 80s. That's just not going to work.
It seems really bizarre. I have another question for you, and I don't know if you have the answer to it or not. Since the president, I want to talk about the BlackBerry again. Since the president was allowed to keep his BlackBerry, are we to assume that there has been some sort of technological advancement with regard to security that the president's BlackBerry would have that my BlackBerry and your BlackBerry don't have?
Yeah, my BlackBerry and your BlackBerry sitting by the fire. We have the same old BlackBerry. Variants and everybody else is walking around, but you know, we also have the same Cadillacs that everybody else has. We don't have the presidential Cadillac, so you better believe his BlackBerry is has been secured. They won't say exactly which agency or who did it. I can tell you, I talked to RIM, the manufacturer of the BlackBerry. They did not create the device, so we have reason to believe, and many people have speculated, that it's a government agency. Some have actually speculated further that it was the NSA. We do know that the BlackBerry, for some odd reason, the number has come out that it cost $2,000. Still trying to figure out where that number is coming from, but that's what's been reported widely. So yes, this is supposed to be secure. It is only supposed to have limited access for family and friends. So that's going to be interesting. And the bottom line is, I think it's a bold step because you know, he still is subject to the Presidential Records Information Act. So you know, anything he does on that could, in fact, be subpoenaed. So, but he's used to using it. I think it's going to make him continue to have that comfort zone. I think he's probably going to be very cautious as to what messages he decides to use that for. But if people want to subpoena that, he's got to go and have somebody pick up the milk, maybe. You know, I don't know.
The president's got a black ops BlackBerry. That's going to be really.
Yeah, but they did. But they removed like some. From what I understand, you can't like ping it for like GPS location. So I believe GPS types of tracking or chips have been removed out of it. So I think it is a stripped down and highly secure BlackBerry.
One of the things, and you mentioned this earlier, Mario, that the president wants to do is he wants to put everybody on the internet who wants access to it, and he's trying to expand it into rural areas. Question is he trying to push the internet and technology onto areas and to people who may not really want it?
You know, I don't. That's a tough question. That's a really good question because, you know, I come from a frame of reference that everybody should want the internet, that the internet should be a utility. The internet should be like water. It should be like electricity. So that's hard for me to remove my own bias to answer that question. However, we have always talked about having a national broadband strategy, and that has not been the case. So the point is, there are people who do want it, and there may be some people who don't want it, but they don't have that option given to them at this point. So now we have Americans across the country who are not connected to this high-speed internet and don't understand what it's capable of doing, how it can increase your access to information, your knowledge, start new businesses, create innovation, do research, help education. Once you get access to it, I believe that does change things. So my suggestion is, I'd rather people have the option and choose not to do it than the option not be there at all.
Well, let me ask you this then, because the tech sector, because all of this would have to cost money to make it happen, whether people wanted it or not, the president's intentions to expand internet access nationally. The tech sector is not insulated from the current economic crisis, I would not think. So what are you seeing as the biggest impact there?
From the tech sector in today's economy?
Yes.
Yeah, job loss. It's been a major. I mean, specifically, you're looking at places that are manufacturing is taking a hit. Companies are looking to do more with less. You are seeing just in recent news, other technology companies like HP and others are making some type of adjustments to not only their workforce, but also to their strategies in a good way, though. And I think right now what we're finding is that I think the technology industry, though, Tony, you can't – this country, businesses, the ecosystem cannot function without information technology. So you have companies like HP, Dell, Microsoft, Google. They're all being very creative now, or I would say more creative than I guess they had to have been in the past, to really understand how they can make the largest impact without it affecting their employee workforce. And I think today's times are making people more innovative, and the mother is the necessity of innovation, and I think it's just making people be more creative now. I'm hoping that the stimulus package, with having a chief technology officer in-house, with $7.2 billion going towards from the stimulus, going towards broadband, with another $19 billion going towards health information records and technology and healthcare. I'm hoping that that is going to, when that money becomes available, make it so that the technology industry can still remain resilient. Because largely, we have been. I mean, we're not immune from the problems, but we've been pretty resilient throughout. If you look at what's going on throughout the country, technology sector has been doing fairly well.
You know, you mentioned that there was a new chief technology officer, and our conversation is coming to a close. But briefly, tell us who this person is, if you know, and what do you know about his or her background?
Yeah, well, he comes from Washington, D.C., and he was the, I believe he was the CIO, which would make him the chief information officer in Washington, D.C. So he comes out of that program. And, you know, one of the interesting things that he did do early on was he invited the community to get involved in technological issues and policy, excuse me, within Washington, D.C. So I do believe that you know, this is going to make I think he's going to have a tough job ahead of him. Mm-hmm. Seriously, a tough job ahead of him. A lot of people are wondering exactly what the role should be and what the role should be about. But nonetheless, the fact is we have someone in that position now, and it's a good thing for the country.
You are absolutely right that he is going to have a big job. If you even look at just the fact that people are having difficulty converting from analog to digital television,
that's right.
A third of those conversions have taken place, and already
that's right.
FCC has
2 days ago, February 17th, was 2 you're absolutely right.
And they've gotten thousands of complaints and questions about that. Mario Armstrong, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tony. Appreciate the time.
That was Mario Armstrong, our regular technology contributor, joining us from the studios of the Baltimore Sun. President Obama pledged in his inaugural speech to restore science to its rightful place as well, and he's wasted no time making good on that promise. For more on how the new administration will impact the sciences, we turn to Al Teich, Director of Science and Policy Programs at the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Al, nice to have you.
Yeah, hi, Tony. Glad to be here.
So how can President Obama boost the economy by investing in science?
Well, first of all, there is about $21.5 billion of money for science in the stimulus bill, the $789 billion stimulus bill. And that's a relatively small part of the stimulus bill, but it's a lot of money for science. And it's going to do two things. It's going to create jobs in the short term because it's going to put scientists to work. For example, the National Institutes of Health, which does medical research, is going to be putting out a large number of grants that they otherwise wouldn't be able to fund, and those are going to fund medical research, and each grant is going to support a group of probably 4 or 5 workers, and that's going to mean 40,000 to 50,000 jobs over the next couple of years.
Well, let me ask you, which areas, which sectors of science are being supported the most under the new plan?
Well, the biggest amount of money is going to the National Institutes of Health. They're getting about $10 billion, which is about a third of their existing budget. So they're getting a 33% increase.
And on the flip side of that, then, which areas in science have lost out in the transition from Bush to Obama?
None of them, really. Defense isn't getting quite the same treatment in the stimulus bill as some of the civilian areas are, but science is being funded pretty much across the board. Energy research, National Science Foundation, which supports basic research in universities in the physical sciences and engineering, they got a big chunk of money. NASA is getting additional money. So just about every major federal agency that does scientific research is getting an increase in its budget under this plan.
Now, the president has appointed scientists to some key positions in his administration. What would you say are some of the president's challenges and opportunities in science?
Well, he's got a lot of work to do. He has science is involved in many of the areas that are top priorities of this administration. Clean energy, for example. There's research that needs to go into that. Dealing with the problem of global climate change is right up at the top of the agenda. And the people that he has named so far, John Holdren, who's going to be his science advisor, as soon as he's confirmed, Jane Lubchenco, who is head of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and who is also going to be the, I think it's Undersecretary of Commerce, and Stephen Chu, who is the new Secretary of Energy. All those people have really solid backgrounds in areas relating to global climate change, and I think they're going to be contributing a great deal to the administration's efforts in this area.
Now, when President Kennedy came into office decades ago, he was identified with the space program. And my question is, do you think this president is going to be identified with really supporting science in a way that no other president has in recent time?
Well, if he follows through on the trends that he started so far, I think he very well may be. He went to it's not coincidental that he went to a science museum in Denver, a museum that has a large number of solar panels on its roof, to sign his sign the stimulus bill. And in saying that, he in fact alluded to President Kennedy and to the moon program in saying that, "I hope this investment," I'm quoting from the president now, "I hope this investment will ignite our imagination once more, spurring new discoveries and breakthroughs in science." Not necessarily in space, by the way, but he said in energy, in medicine, in energy, and to make our economy stronger and our nation more secure and our planet safer for our children. Those are lofty goals, and I think science is a key part of all of them.
Al, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Al Teich is Director of Science and Policy Programs at the American Association for the Advancement of Science. He was at our headquarters in Washington, D.C. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. Last year, we heard the story of Timothy Cole. He was a Texas man who was convicted of a rape he didn't commit. Cole died behind bars in 1999, and this month, after 10 years of fighting by the family, a Texas judge reversed the ruling and made Cole the first person in the state to be exonerated posthumously. For more, we spoke to Cole's brother, Corey Session, and Jeff Blackburn, a trial lawyer and the chief counsel for the Innocence Project of Texas. I started by asking Jeff what held this case up for so long.
Well, it's Texas, and that necessarily means that you're going to have a lot of institutional resistance to the idea of doing the right thing and to seeing justice happen in the criminal justice system, and this case wasn't any different. We went to the authorities in Lubbock, who are the ones responsible, who are the ones that caused this miscarriage of justice and ultimately Tim's death, and got nowhere. We beat our heads up against a wall. We had to get very creative. We found a way to get this case to Austin. We found a way to find a really good judge. And it takes time. We persevered. The family stayed very strong throughout all of it. And we had the definite will, and we eventually found a way.
Corey, I would imagine that this is a bittersweet victory for you and your family. It has been 10 years since your brother died in prison. What does this exoneration mean to you and to your family?
Well, it restores his name, and it restores it back to what it was. But this is just one part of an ongoing saga that we're going to do, that we're striving toward, because for Tim to have gone to prison the way he did, it was meant to happen, and now it's meant to change the way Texas does business insofar as in our justice system.
And until the final decision was made, did you reach a point that you didn't believe it was ever going to happen?
We believed that it would happen. We just didn't know how it would happen. Even when he died, we didn't know. Some people gave up. Some people said, well, that's it. But my mother and I and a couple of my other brothers, we just knew one day it would happen.
Jeff, this is the first time that a deceased person has been exonerated. What will this exoneration mean for other cases?
Well, a couple of things, really. First of all, it's, I think, going to open up a way to exonerate somebody posthumously in Texas that's never been opened before. You've got to know, it took us to get from A to B, we kind of had to invent another alphabet by using a procedure that that a lot of legal scholars have said you couldn't be used and couldn't apply, but in fact we found out that it did and we made it apply. So in that narrow group of cases, it's going to create, I think, a new precedent. On a broader scale, something bigger has happened here still. Namely, this is the very first time, even though Texas has had a lot of people exonerated, this is really the first time that a good, hard, strong look has ever been taken at a case like this, and questions like why really asked of cases like this. And because of what we've gotten done in that respect, I think that we're paving the way towards examining real truths in these real cases in the future.
I want to ask you specifically about Lubbock because of the resistance that you received there from the criminal justice system and those people who were in charge. Now that the exoneration is official and it has taken place, have you found that any of those people who were obstacles to this before have come around, or are they still holding on to the positions that they originally held?
I think there's some softening amongst some of them. Judge Darnell, who at the time was Prosecutor Darnell and prosecuted Mr. Cole, I think has begun to come around. Corey would be a better judge of that because he met with him just last week. And I think he feels some genuine remorse over what happened. It's too bad that he declined our invitation to come to the hearing and explain his side of the story fully. I hope that he will do that at some point and be a little more forthcoming. But at the same time, I think he's shown some emotion. On the other hand, the current district attorney in Lubbock, who I think embodies everything that's wrong with the criminal justice system in this state, took the position publicly that what he actually said was, we haven't reviewed the case and we don't intend to. All I can tell you is that the prosecutors and police did nothing wrong. And then he proceeded to blame the rape victim for the miscarriage of justice that occurred here.
Corey, what about
now, that's evil.
Corey, what about that meeting you had with the judge, the former prosecutor, now judge? What did he say about how this has ended?
Well, it was actually, it was an unrehearsed, unscheduled meeting. My mother simply went there to try and gain some closure. She just wanted to see the old courtroom where he was convicted. And just by happenstance, the courtroom directly behind it, Judge Darnell was trying an aggravated rape case in his courtroom, and he saw us looking at him, and he left the bench, put his court in recess. He came into the jury room where the bailiffs have asked us to go, and he came in there, and he was visibly shaken. He was trembling. His eyes were watery at times, and he said that he had told DA Matt Pyle that he wanted to know what went wrong in this case, because that was the last case he had ever prosecuted, and it has haunted him ever since he got the news about the DNA test results.
Let me end the conversation with this, and I thank you both for coming on and updating the story for our listeners. Corey, what will your family do now that this long saga is over?
Now, whatever legal ramifications that we can pursue, we're going to pursue them. Because of Tim's case, a lot more light has been shined on Texas and how the majority of these exonerees who have gotten out of prison were simply sent there on one thing, one person's eyewitness identification. And we're going to delve as far as we can to hold those people accountable.
Jeff and Corey, thank you both for coming on.
You're very welcome. Thanks a lot.
Corey Session is Timothy Cole's brother, and Jeff Blackburn is a trial lawyer and the chief counsel for the Innocence Project of Texas. He spoke to us from the studios of KOHM in Lubbock, Texas.
During the year 2001, 2002, 2003, I experimented with a banned substance that eventually triggered a positive test.
That is New York Yankee slugger Alex Rodriguez coming clean, or at least claiming to come clean, about past steroid use. A prepared statement was given at a press conference on Tuesday. It's the biggest story in sports this week. And here to talk about that and more is Chad Brown, who blogs at Alpha Blog Sports. Chad, nice to have you back.
Yeah, good to be here.
New York is quite a place right now in terms of the sports news. A-Rod's big secret out of the bag. Here he is in the opening week of spring training explaining himself, saying that with the help of a cousin, he took a substance known as Bole. He said he was young and stupid. Well, we would agree with that, wouldn't we?
Yeah, I think we definitely would agree with that. But it just seems like he's having trouble getting his story straight. I mean, we know that he's used something, but it's now the cousin comes into the picture, and you've got guys saying, you know, this doesn't taint everything that everybody ever did during this time, but It's not a good situation. I mean, he called in a PR guy who had helped out Sarah Palin, you know. So he's really trying to cover himself, and there's no way he's going to cover himself up. It's not a question of him being sorry. It seems like he's sorry even after all these years that he got caught, and whether he knew it was wrong, right or wrong at the time, is kind of irrelevant at this point.
I mean, every year we go through this with the New York Yankees at spring training, with a news conference trying to explain whether they did or did not use steroids. We've had Clemens, we've had Pettit, we've had Giambi, and now we've got A-Rod. Would A-Rod go into your Yankees Liars Hall of Fame?
I'd say first balloter, definitely.
Here's what he had to say about his future. Listen to this.
I know that I'm in a position where I have to earn my trust back, and over time, I'm confident that at the end of my career, people will see this for what it is, a stupid mistake and a lesson learned for a guy with a lot of baseball to play.
And the question is whether or not the fans are going to forgive him. New York fans, I'm not sure. I guess if the Yankees win the World Series, it all will be forgiven. I know his teammates showed up at the press conference in a show of solidarity and support. What did you make of that?
I thought that was a good thing for his behalf and for the team. And even you heard Jeter the next day saying, you know what, he did something wrong, but he's still our teammate, and it's not like everybody – Everyone thinks it taints the whole era. That whole era, it doesn't. So I think it's a good show of support, but it's also understanding, like, hey, we still have spring training. We still have a season to prepare for. So whether or not this is going on, we still have to prepare. You know, whatever he did, we need him now. You know.
Yeah. If you're Barry Bonds, what are you saying to yourself? Do you have a smirk on your face as you're watching this unfold with all these other players now?
I think you would, but Barry might also be thinking, well, where was all this love where was this love from the teammates when I was going through my thing, or still am going through my ordeal? Yeah.
All right, let's move on to a couple of other things in baseball before we get to the NBA, because there's some good stuff to talk about there as well. Ken Griffey Jr. going back to Seattle, which is a place where A-Rod actually played at one point of his career. People are having mixed reactions to this. What are you hearing and what are you thinking about this?
Well, I actually just recently heard about it. It's a nice story. It's a nice it's a nice homecoming. He turned down the deal from the Atlanta Braves, so it seems like it's a good story. Whether it's actually going to help the Mariners remains to be seen.
Now, do you think outside of Los Angeles that much of the baseball world gives a darn about whether or not Manny Ramirez comes back here to play with the Dodgers again?
That's very interesting. I think it's probably at this point anything involving Manny is just, oh, it's Manny being Manny again. So I wish him well wherever he ends up, as long as it's not back in Boston.
You know. I understand that. Well, we have to wait and see. Every day in Los Angeles, they keep saying it's sort of a Manny watch, and we just don't know what's going to happen. But I guess something will have to happen sooner rather than later.
I wish Torrey all the best of luck in dealing with that. He's a good man. Hopefully he doesn't have to deal with that. You know, he's having enough fallout from his book, but that's another story.
Yeah, it is another story. Let's talk about the NBA. This is the day. Today is the trading deadline, and there's all sorts of rumors all over the place, including your own city, New York. I don't know if you've heard the very latest, but before we get to New York, let's talk about this possibility of Shaq and LeBron in Cleveland. I know you've heard about that one.
Oh, yeah, I just heard about it only a couple hours ago, but I've heard about it. So I've been trying to find out whether this is actually going to happen or whether it's just being discussed. But Shaq and LeBron, I mean, wow, even half a Shaq and LeBron, that would...
It would be crazy, wouldn't it?
It would be unbelievable. It'd be unbelievable. We'd get another Celtics Cavalier rematch in the playoffs, and you throw Shaq into the equation? Wow.
That is crazy. Now, talking about the team that Shaq might be moved from, the Phoenix Suns, they have dismantled a team that challenged for the Western Conference title a number of years in a row, and getting rid of Shaq would the only person left on that team recognizable would be Steve Nash.
No, absolutely, absolutely. It's crazy, especially considering since Gentry took over, they went back to that run and gun style. Now, granted, it was against the Clippers, but still, it seems like now they finally have a system where all these guys can play in, but they're still breaking it up. Has there been any news on Amari?
Not yet. We just keep seeing his name popping up in a lot of different places. Apparently 29 teams had an interest in him outside of the team that he is currently playing for, but we'll have to wait until the trading deadline comes to an official close to see what's going to happen with him. Here's one thing I want to get with you as we end this really briefly. Before the All-Star break, the word was L.A., Cleveland, Boston for the championship, maybe Orlando. Now that we're right after the break, are those still the four teams, or is there somebody else that's in the mix?
No, I definitely like those four. You're not going to – I mean, like we discussed last week, L.A. is tops, Boston, regrettably for me to say it, is tops. Cleveland still has LeBron. Orlando is a dark horse, but we'll see what happens. I mean, if Shaq moves – that might jumble the order, but I would keep those four teams in there.
Well, somebody reminded me about the San Antonio Spurs, that they always make a run after the All-Star break. So you can't count them out either.
No, I think with San Antonio, that's more of a case. Even though you don't speak about them, you know they're going to be there. Plus, this is an odd-numbered year, so their chances of winning the title are actually very, very good.
Chad Brown, thank you very much, my man.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Chad Brown, who writes about sports at alphablogsports.blogspot.com. And now it's letter time. Our editor, Sasha Woodruff, is here with me. Hey, Sasha.
Hey, Tony. How's it going?
Going great, actually. So it sounds like the economic downturn and California prison reform caught the attention of listeners this week.
That's right. Linda Kinlaw, who listens to us from Madison, Alabama, sent us these thoughts after she heard Monday's segment about a court order to reduce California's prison population. She wrote, "We had a system that was working, but educating people in prison was rebuked by politicians who saw the rationale of educating and rehabilitation of human beings who commit a crime as voting capital. Lock them up and throw away the key was popular. Prison systems are a business, and look at who's running them."
Then listener Reg Edwards of Randallstown, Maryland, mused after a segment on the economic downturn. He wrote, I remember something Malcolm X suggested as a way to strengthen yourself, your family, and your neighborhood. I'd love to see if contributor Dr. Julianne Malveaux feels it is relevant today. Basically, he stated that one should buy and do business with the people that are closest to you, that is, family, then neighbors, then neighborhood, etc. It seems that even the Buy From Your Local Farms movement has a similar philosophy.
Then Camille Cox commented on our website after hearing the segment on the black and white comedy duo Tim Reed and Tom Dreesen. She noted, "I think it's unfortunate that this book is not getting enough press coverage. In the age of Obama, it seems that the press is still brainwashed to think that we can't get past racial issues."
Daniel Federa in Evans, Georgia, wrote in after he heard a listener lament the state of black media tied to the cancellation of News and Notes. He wrote, "I didn't realize that News and Notes was black media," that's in quotes. "News and Notes is one of my favorite programs, topical, well-read, and well-produced. Maybe at some level I recognized some of the reporters and commentators were black, but for me that was just part of the perspective you brought to the stories. You do good work. After the last show airs, I'll miss a good news show, period."
And that's it for letters. Please keep your comments coming over the next few weeks.
And to write us, just log on to npr.org and click on Contact Us. When you get there, you'll see lots of shows to choose from. Make sure you choose News and Notes when you write to us.
And be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name.
Sasha, thank you very much.
No problem, Tony.
That's our show for today. Glad you could join us. To listen or subscribe, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org, or the blog at nprnewsandviews.org. Tomorrow, renewable energy, reduced emissions, resource conservation. Candidate Obama made sweeping green promises. How will he keep those? We'll look at his environment and energy agenda.